Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor to have Amy Goodman and Carl Diehl here today on this wonderful day. I'm a huge fan, as you guys already know. I have the clip somewhere. I'm going to pull it up right now.
Well, we know you're huge. Like, how tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
Okay.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I'm mesmerized by your audience here.
Yeah,
check
there's
it
like
out.
Around 40,000 people watching right now. So, live people watching. But here, I'm going to start off the broadcast by showing the first time I ever saw Amy in the real world, because I've been listening to your voice for years every morning on Democracy Now! As you tirelessly engage in work of advocacy and doing investigative reporting for years and years, offering a voice to the voiceless. You were a very inspirational figure for what I do as well. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful that you're here. And thank you, Carl, so much for being here as well. And also doing this documentary that we're going to be talking about. Amy Goodman, for those of you who don't know, is the legendary host and co-founder of Democracy Now!, one of the foremost independent news publications that broadcasts on radio, TV, and online, and I believe 1,500 stations, right? At least I got that from
public radio and television stations.
I got that from the doc.
Globally, yeah.
Okay, so if you were wrong, that would be on you, Carl.
So you watched it.
I did, yes. Amy has been fearlessly reporting from the front lines of global conflicts and amplifying voices that mainstream media routinely ignores for over 3 decades. Her motto is "Steal the Story, Please," which also happens to be the name of the new documentary chronicling her fearless career in journalism. Follows Amy as she takes on soldiers, politicians, and corporate media in pursuit of the truth. The documentary has already won over a dozen awards at major film festivals. Also joining me is Carl Diehl, the film's co-director and a former investigative journalist and a longtime documentary filmmaker whose work has consistently looked at power, media, and resistance from the ground up. In Steal the Story, Please, he turns Amy Goodman's story into a film about what independent journalism preserves and what the public loses when that space disappears. Amy, also, you brought another friend.
This is Azu Goodpup. She is one of the leading news hounds. No disrespect to Kaya. She is one of the most important paparazzi of our time.
I see that. Kaya also loves being in front of the camera. She has she's gotten really used to it through the many years that I've been doing, you know, merch photo shoots and things like that. And she knows how to strike a pose, and she will get in here when she feels like she's not being sufficiently paid attention.
Well, Zazu's probably the most popular character in the film. Tell him what happened at Telluride.
This is such an interesting story. oh my God, I don't know if I should spend time telling this story. At the Telluride Film Festival, it's different from all others. You don't know what films are going to be there. And Carl and Tia's film, Steal the Story, Please, was invited to the film festival. When we got there, we then learned that all different films, and the film about Bruce Springsteen was also there, Deliver Me From Nowhere. And Jeremy Strong and Jeremy Allen White were there. Actually, Bruce came. And so did John Landau, because it's a story of that friendship.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important one. I didn't know what to do with Zazu at the time because I had to leave her in New York. So I asked a friend, Patty, to take care of her. And then it turns out that this film was there. John Landau was there. She had gone out with his brother for quite a long time. John Landau's brother, Patty, who was taking care of Zazu. And I said, oh, my goodness, this film is happening. Deliver Me From Nowhere. John Landau is here. Bruce is here. And she said, what is wrong with this picture? You are a Telluride and I'm sitting taking care of your dog in New York.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. You said Bruce on a first name basis. Has Bruce Springsteen been on the show, I assume?
We just had our 30th anniversary, and we had this big event at the Riverside Church, this famous church where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his speech against the war in Vietnam a year to the day before he was assassinated, April 4th, 1967, he gave the speech. So that's where we had the 30th anniversary event. The problem was 2,000 people were going to pack the place on February 23rd, and then Snowmageddon happened, and the day before we had to cancel it.
Oh, no.
So then we found a date about a month later, and Wynton Marsalis was going to go down the aisle, this jazz legend, but he had to go to Japan, so he wasn't going to be a part of it. But Patti Smith rejoined. She was with us at the 20th anniversary, and now she could attend on March 23rd, as did Michael Stipe of REM and Hooray for the Riff Raff, the singing Palante, Ever Forward. Michael Stipe, Patti Smith, and to wrap up, I looked out at the thousands of people and said, we couldn't figure out how to end tonight. Oh, but I see someone in the audience who could maybe help us. The boss, Bruce Springsteen. So he got up, he sang, as he is singing all over the country now, streets of Minneapolis. And then together, they all came up on the stage, Patty, Michael, Hooray, and Bruce. And they sang Patty's legendary song, People of the Power. And maybe that's a great way to start here, because that is the principle of independent media. People Absolutely. Have the power. You know, when we're going to cover war, we're not brought to you by weapons manufacturers. When we're going to cover the climate catastrophe, we're not brought to you by the oil, gas, or coal companies. And we're going to cover inequality, not brought to you by the banks and the financial institutions, but brought to you by listeners, viewers, and readers who are so committed to an authentic, independent voice. That's the kind of media that'll save us.
Absolutely. What do you say about the state of media right now? Now that we have Kalshi and even Polymarket, these like gambling websites that are also purchasing ad space and doing collaborations with the likes of CNN, do you feel like the state of mainstream media is in a worse position than it has ever been?
I mean, the legacy media is really in a shambles. We had on a Washington Post reporter. She had done an anatomy of the first day of the bombing of Iran, right? The girls' school in Manab in southern Iran, where like 175 people died, about a dozen teachers, but overwhelmingly primary school girls. And I think it was a U.S. Missile that most likely was used in this. President Trump tried to say it was Iran was using it, but they don't use U.S. these particular U.S. missiles.
The Tomahawk missiles,
The Tomahawk missile. So she had done this really explosive expose, but she wasn't doing it for the Washington Post because she had just been laid off, as had hundreds of Washington Post journalists. Jeff Bezos, who founded Amazon, owns the Washington Post. They developed their motto, democracy dies in the darkness, under Bezos, but that's exactly what's happening now. They laid off almost their entire Middle East department, their division of reporters, as U.S. and Israel attacks Iran. And this is extremely serious. What is happening to the media? The corporate mergers, you have CBS and you have, you know, Skydance merging with Paramount, owning CBS in 60 Minutes. And how did they get approval for this corporate merger? So President Trump sues CBS for its 60 Minutes editing of a Kamala Harris interview. And you know all this, and I'm sure you've talked for hours about it. I don't think it would have stood up in court, but it wasn't worth it to CBS to fight this. Instead, they paid Trump $16 million, which supposedly goes to the presidential library. Why? They had much more to make in a $6 billion merger between Paramount and Skydance that had to be approved by Trump's FCC. And that's exactly what happened. And now Paramount is making the moves to take over Warner Brothers Discovery. And it'll be HBO, CNN, we already own CBS. But that's where Carl can pick it up, because Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson have joined 1,000 other directors and Hollywood stars, and we'll take it from there in challenging.
She's such a great host. She's such a great news host. See, yeah, you immediately threw it to the guests.
You can just go back and take a nap if you want right now.
we got the real pro. We got the real pro in here.
No, I mean, it's true though. But the narrowing of the mainstream media through all these mergers and stuff does create space for voices like yours to just sort of proliferate now. And there are all these different ways that that people are consuming news now, and it's by necessity. And I think in a lot of ways, what Amy's been doing for 30 years and what Democracy Now! Does has sort of helped widen that landscape a little bit at the same time.
No, absolutely.
So, so the mergers are screwing everything up. I mean, like Amy said, there's been this movement now called Block the Merger. Everybody thinks this is a done deal, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Paramount, it hasn't been approved yet. And once it does get approved, the states can also get involved and try and stop this. So, you know, Jane Fonda is one of our executive producers. Rosario Dawson is one of our executive producers. Julie Cohen, Tia, we've all signed this letter.
Tom Morello.
Of our colleagues.
Oh, but
we've signed this letter to let people know, and are trying to bring some attention to it, because it not only affects the business, but it affects the consumer and what it is that we have access to, right?
Yeah.
You know?
So, no, absolutely.
Because freedom of the press, the reason it's enshrined in the Constitution, is much more than freedom of the press. It's about the public's right to know. And that's how a democracy functions. And when you erode that, When the president calls the press the enemy of the people, that is taking us down an authoritarian road that must be challenged. As Maria Ressa says on Democracy Now!, that's included in Steal the Story, Please, the new documentary, the rights we lose today, we may never get back.
Yeah. So,
can I see you fanning out to Amy here? Are you going to play?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, I was going to move on to the questions, but you're right. This is the first time I ever saw Amy Goodman in real life at the DNC last year or 2 years ago.
Oh my God. Oh DNC. My God. Excuse me. Oh my God. I'm such a big fan of you.
And you had no idea who I was. You're like, what is this tall person yelling at me for?
Amazing. Can I take a photo with you?
Yes, you can.
Oh my God. Oh my God. We're live right now. Oh my God. Chat. I don't even know if this is. Hassan.
It's Hassan the Hunt.
Hassan. Oh, you guys have? You guys know who I am? Oh my God. That's crazy. You're amazing. I love you. I love you so much. I love all of you guys. You guys are incredible. That's, thank you. Hi. Of course. Hi. Hassan.
Sharif.
Nice to meet you. What's going on? I got the hat and everything. I'm also a donor. Someone sent me from your donation.
Liver, organ. What organ?
No.
Not an organ.
No.
This is incredible. You guys are inspirational. You literally are so important in motivating me to do what I do now. There are. I don't even know. Are we live right now? Can people see it?
Everyone, check out democracynow.org.
Oh no, your work. You guys are.
Spend 2 hours a day for the convention, and so we've got endless stuff on YouTube and on our website, democracynow.org.
Can I take a photo with you?
Yes,
is that okay?
Oh my God.
I'm gonna cry a little bit. I'm fangirling.
Why don't you come visit us in
New York? No, absolutely. So that's what I was gonna say. Someone from your like donation department or whatever sent me an email because like they didn't know who I was. They just like sent me an email as like a donor, and I was like, I don't think they know who I am. Well, now I know that you do. But I meant like when the donation department was like, hey, you should come check out the studio as a big donor. I was like, no, I don't think they know who I am at all.
Let's take a picture.
I'll all right. Is it okay? Can we hear
you? Yeah, I'm on it.
All right, there it is.
Yeah, that was our first interaction.
And you know, that's amazing because I'm with all my colleagues there, and it's really a brain trust of Democracy Now! Hani Masood almost played on the Egyptian basketball team.
Oh, wow.
He was right there, and he's the first voice you hear in Steal the Story, Please, because we were at the UN Climate Summit in Poland, and we'd just gotten off the show, and we saw Trump's sole representative there, and Hani's saying to me exactly who he is, and you hear his voice as we move forward. And then there's Nermeen Sheikh, who is the co-host on Democracy Now! In the white jacket.
Oh, where is she?
And next him is, there's Nermeen Sharif, Sharif Abdelkaddous. He's right there. And, you know, Sharif is now at Drop Site News. He's behind. And in the documentary, there's this whole part at the Republican convention in St. Paul, where it was John McCain and Sarah Palin, and there were mass protests against the war in Iraq. And Sharif and Nicole Salazar went to cover it, two of our producers, and they immediately got arrested, and Nicole was slammed to the ground. And so I was on the convention floor, and you know, because you've been inside and you've been outside, it's hard to get to the convention floor. Finally, I got there. I had to ask a bunch of questions. I got a call. Sharif and Nicole have been arrested. Oh my God. So we go racing out. We get to that corner. I try to ask for a supervisor, police officer, saying we need to have those two reporters released, but instead they dragged me in and they arrested me. And interestingly, after hours, we were all brought to separate places, but there was such outcry that we were released. I went back to the convention center and someone to interview me, I think it was in the NBC skybox. And at the end of the interview, when the camera was turned off. The reporter said, I don't get it. Why wasn't I arrested? I said, oh, were you covering the protest too? Mm-hmm. And he said, no. I said, oh, okay. So I said, I don't get arrested in the convention center either. We got to be here. We got to be in the corporate suites to find out who's funding this. And we have to be out in the streets where the uninvited guests are. And that's what it is to have a media that is independent, that is not there just to bring you the voices of power, but is there to bring you the people, as Nermeen says, that are outside the frame, and not only get them inside, but center them.
Yeah. And look at this respect that you're getting here, Amy. I don't think Hassan's not talked for this long on his feet.
No, of course not. I had a somewhat similar experience. I covered the protest the first day of the DNC. I was outside. I was at the protest. And then I covered extensively the uncommitted movement on the last day. I took advantage of the influencer route, and I was invited by...
I remember that.
Yeah, the creators for Kamala, and they actually were pretty good at like finding a space for myself, because they couldn't like figure out exactly what I was doing. So I took advantage of that, like, because they didn't understand what like Twitch streaming is, and they ended up giving me this like massive box seat that was even better seats than like CNN, that had paid like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to get. But they revoked the credentials that I had on the last day, because I had interviewed the uncommitted movement, and then also was, you know, creating a big fuss about not having a Palestinian speaker, and how this was a major point of contention, how this was going to lead to real issues down the line for Harris's electability. And they revoked my press credentials in front of a New York Times reporter who was actually covering me in real time in front of like, you know, 70,000 people. And I had to go and cover the rest of the event from my hotel room. They made it impossible for me to be there and continue doing live
coverage.
And
how do you think your coverage changed from that front row seat to being in your hotel room? Which was better, do you think?
Oh, I don't mind doing it from the hotel room at all. It didn't, like, my commentary didn't change at all. Well, I had to whisper because, like, someone, I was yelling a little too much in my hotel room, apparently, because I was, when I heard Kamala Harris talk about, you know, how she was going to commandeer the most lethal military, I was like, oh no, this is like disastrous. Like, this is disastrous, pro-war commentary coming from the Democratic president, like the Democratic presidential contender. This is not going to be received well. Of course, none of those warnings were heard. But yeah, I had someone down the hall come in, knock on my door and be like, listen, I like your commentary, but you got to, you know, keep it down a little bit. So I had to whisper yell for the rest of the night. But I want to start off by asking the question. I think I might know the answer to this as well, because it's like something that I also embody. Why do you encourage others to steal your story?
I think of an exclusive as a failure, because just us having it, well, what matters is people talking about it everywhere. That's when people can decide what they want to do about it. So in the documentary, Steal the Story, Please, we go out to Standing Rock, to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. It's this epic struggle. It was the first presidential race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And April 1st, the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, invited people to come because the Dakota Access Pipeline looked like it was going to be built, and they were afraid about it polluting the Missouri River, I think the longest river in North America, right next to the reservation. And she said anyone who would come could stay on her property, set up your teepee or your tent. And she thought a couple dozen people would come. Yep. Hundreds came, then thousands came, then all these resistance camps were built.
Like veterans, you know, people from all different walks of
indigenous
life.
People from Latin
water
America. Water is life. First Nations from Canada. It was the largest indigenous gathering in decades in the United States, and their non-native allies. And so we were covering it from afar, but came from New York Labor Day weekend. And we covered a group of people that went onto property that they said was their burial ground. And a judge was going to rule on whether it could be excavated a few days later. But they were shocked to see bulldozers there already beginning the excavation. And so girls, women, men, boys stood in front of these earth-crushing machines. It's very dangerous. I mean, we know what happened to Rachel Corrie, March 16th, 2003, 3 days before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. She was in Rafah. She was in Gaza. She's standing in front of a pharmacist's home about to be demolished. The home, she stands in front of it with a bright fluorescent vest, and she was crushed to death. So I was very aware of that. And I see these women and girls standing in front of it. It was scary. But their presence that day, a Labor Day weekend, 2016, the bulldozers decided to pull back. One, two, three, four, five, six of them pulling back. But then the security guards of DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, unleashed dogs on the protesters. They called themselves water protectors. And we filmed a dog with its mouth and nose covered with blood. You know, the dogs were like about the size of Kaya. They were, I think, German shepherds. And they were being gassed. They were being bitten. And we then had to go back to New York, and we posted it online. And within 24 hours, there were 14 million views of this video. Now, I'd been invited into CNN and then MSNBC and all these. And I would say, why don't you cover the climate crisis? And they'd say, the executives upstairs say people aren't interested. There won't be any more eyeballs on us. I think any executive would drool to get 14 million views.
Oh, yeah.
So that just showed the lie that people were interested. And then media started to pick it up all over. And it was on all the networks, the video coverage that we had done. And that's what I consider successful reporting. Steal this story, please. Or someone we're going to have on tomorrow, Alia Rahman. Alia is the woman who was driving in Minneapolis to her doctor, and she was, immigration officials stopped her. This is just a few months ago, smashed her window, dragged her out of her car. She said, I'm disabled. She's autistic and disabled. And they said, too late. And they take her to the Whipple Detention Center. And we interview her then. Ilhan Omar, the only Somali refugee Congress member, invites her to the State of the Union. She goes there. She's really injured, but she felt it was too important not to go to the State of the Union. She's sitting in the galley with all gallery with all the other invited guests. And you know how that was. The Republicans were standing up, sitting down, standing up, applauding, sitting down. That would work the other way, too, if it was Democrat. And so at one point when President Trump was denigrating the people of the Twin Cities, Alia stood up quietly, just bearing witness. And security took her out. And she had already been brutalized. And now she was being taken down again. So she's arrested. She goes to jail. She was supposed to be on our show the next day for her response to the State of the Union. She got out of jail at 4 a.m. and she says, Amy, as she comes on Democracy Now! The next day, I'm wearing the same clothes I wore last night because I just got out of jail. And I thought it's important to live up to my commitment. Well, now she is suing. And tomorrow, her and her lawyer will come on to talk about their case. But when we had her tell her story of what happened at SOTU, the State of the Union, all the papers picked up the story because we don't have your typical pundits on who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We have people closest to the story at the target end of policy. And that's the kind of voice we need picked up and stolen to be widely disseminated in the press. Because it's how the rest of the world learns about us is through the press. It's how we learn about a lot of things in this country. And it's got to be through something other than a corporate lens.
No, it's absolutely. I have a similar motto as well, probably picked up from your assessment too, from your motto. But that is my mentality as far as the things that I talk about where people will be like, oh, I use your talking points when talking to my family members. I'm like, well, that's the whole point. I want you to internalize what I'm talking about and then be able to effectively communicate the right side of a lot of these issues, a lot of these causes so that you can then, you know, change their minds as well. In the same way that I've been able to do that to people in my audience. So
now I have a question. All these people that are writing in, which just is amazing to see all the emojis and the words.
Yeah.
If anyone's in the Los Angeles area, one of the things that we're doing as Tia and Carl take the film around, it just opened in New York and now it's in Los Angeles at the various Lemleys, is doing fundraisers for independent media. And of course, I got my start at Pacifica Radio, founded in 1949 in the Bay Area. We're going to do one for KPFA this weekend. But tomorrow is the big day for KPFK because, of course, you live in KPFK land. You live in Los Angeles. And we're going to be at the Lemley Royal on Santa Monica Boulevard in West LA, and they're having two screenings of the documentary at 1:10 and 7:10, and we're going to do a Q&A afterwards, and there's a dinner before the 7:10 one, and anyone who wants to come out and see these films, it's a great way to both see the films and support independent media. And you can go to kpfk.org, their website, and get tickets right there. It's tomorrow. That's the 17th of April at 1:10 and 7:10. Is this allowed on your show?
Of course.
Oh,
and
my
you should
God.
Support independent media, yeah. of course. Yeah. If you can come out on Friday for one of those two shows, do. If you can't, you can still come see the film, because we're opening at the Lemleys. We're going to be in, as long as people come, they'll keep playing the film. So...
And you've had a record.
There.
I mean, this isn't my film. This is Carl and Tia's. And Carl and Tia are Oscar-nominated filmmakers who made Trouble the Water about Katrina. Tia did The Janes, won 3 Emmys for that underground abortion network in Chicago. But you can say you broke a record in New York at the IFC, where it's continuing to play.
Yeah. No, we're independent, you know, just like you, just like Amy. And we... we're rolling this film out now. We're going to be opening in, you know, probably upwards of 100 theaters nationwide, which is pretty big for a doc. But it's all because in New York, people came out and saw the film, and it was the most successful documentary opening in the last decade. So it's a big deal, and it's cool. And it's because of Amy. It's because people love this woman, and it's also because people want to hear what she has to say and what the film has to say about the importance of independence media. I mean, look, watching you two here side by side, it's really cool, because, you know, you would think you guys do different things, that you're completely different, but I can see the same spirit imbues everything you do that I've been watching Amy
and
do.
And you see
for
a
so
similar
long.
Hat.
And it might be the hat.
Well,
I don't know.
I try my best.
No, but it's like you don't care about the artifice so much. You just, it's about what's real and what, and your job is to call people out and to ask people questions. And it's really that simple. And so, you know, people might think it's rude when Amy's, or the president might think it's rude when Amy asks him a tough question, right?
Yeah.
Like we see with Clinton, but that's just her doing her job, asking the question. And because she's independent, because you're independent, you don't need to stick your head in the sand. You don't have somebody above you telling you that we're going to lose advertising if you don't step into line.
Yeah.
So it's really important.
Or access journalism as well. I feel like that's become the normal state of affairs in legacy publishers, where they're too afraid of not being invited to the press pool. I mean, it's accelerated even worse under the Trump administration, especially the second time around, where they were demanding that the Pentagon press pool sign loyalty pledges to never release any information that the government could declare classified, that they had to get pre-approval before they report on anything from the Pentagon side. That's just not journalism at all. It's just you're becoming a stenographer for the state.
I call it the access of evil. right? Trading truth for access. And it's not worth it. Politicians need journalists more than journalists need politicians. It's not worth asking the softball questions to stay there and ask the soft questions. I either ask the hard questions or do something else.
Do you feel like there are still people that are carrying on that spirit? I mean, there's obviously independent media outlets. One that you guys also work with quite frequently is Dropsite. There's now Zateo as well, and many others. But are there some that you feel like are not getting the same level of attention?
Well, you know, in the documentary, you see Jeremy and where Jeremy Scahill, who co-founded with Ryan Grimm, Dropsite News, he gets his start at Democracy Now. And then Jeremy goes on to co-found The Intercept and then goes to Dropsite News. And then you've got Dave Isay, who ends up doing StoryCorps, which is really actually very important. It's a cultural commentary of our time, just people interviewing each other, grandparents, grandchildren, and the Smithsonian is picking up all that. Sharif Abdelkaddous, his work is absolutely critical. He started at Democracy Now! He was going to be a corporate banker, and then he went a different route. And that was right before he saw an ad at Democracy Now! Some professor sent it to him, or a friend. And it was right before the U.S. invaded Iraq. And because he spoke Arabic, we were at DCTV, which is closest national broadcast to Ground Zero. And that's a part of the film. But within a few weeks, John Alpert, great filmmaker and journalist who runs DCTV, asked Sharif to come with him and the Renault brothers to Iraq. The Renault brothers were Craig and Brent Renault, a dynamic filmmaking duo from Arkansas. And they would go on to make many documentaries. Sharif spent that time with them. And then Brent became the first Western journalist to die in Ukraine. And Craig, his brother, to honor him so that we don't forget his memory and his great work, did the documentary armed only with a camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renault. And that went on to be Oscar nominated. And I went with them to the Oscars this year, sitting with Brent and Craig's mother, Georgianne. And that work will hopefully continue in all different ways.
Okay,
those are good pictures.
So I got some exclusives here. Okay, I got some exclusives here. So I'm gonna show them one by one. Some of these might be never before seen photos. I wanted to ask you what's going on in these photos.
Wow.
I got these from
Jeremy. You're great.
So what's happening here? There's a young Jeremy Scahill right there.
He was like 23 or 24. Jeremy used to work at the Catholic Worker in New York on First Street and First Avenue, and that's where I met him. I was doing a story, then he started calling. I want to work with you. I want to work with you. And as he's
stalking her,
he says it was,
that's a good journalist, though. That's a good reporter.
Good journalist.
Constantly nagging.
As he said, he bothered me so much saying, I need to work with you, that he said he thought I would either take out a restraining order on him or give him a job. So finally, he came to WBAI. That's Pacifica Radio. That's the KPFK of New York. And we started working together. And then I got the chance to interview Ken Sarawiwa. He's a great writer. Actually, he wrote a soap opera in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country and the producer of the greatest oil, the most oil in Africa. And he was not going to forsake his people, the Ogoni people. They were taking on Shell, which had crisscrossed Ogoni land with pipelines.
Yeah.
And he started to talk about it everywhere. And the difference between him and activists inside Nigeria is Ken had the wherewithal to take it out. And that was very threatening to Shell because he was taking a story to the Western nations, where people would push back. An activist called us in New York, said, Ken Sarawiwa is in New York. Can he come in to WBAI? This was right at the beginning of Democracy Now! And I was on a show called Wake Up Call. And I said, I'm so sorry. We are totally booked today. I didn't know who Ken was. And he said, but he's only here for this morning. I said, 2 minutes. He can come in and he can say what he's going to do.
Classic.
And as he started,
as the credits are rolling.
No, but this was at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to the end. You're right. As the credits are rolling. Yes, people get
every
into
time.
That. But at the beginning, as he started talking, and I said to him, you know, he said that the oil companies like dictatorships because they can crack down on the people who protest the despoilation of their mangrove forests. And he said, I am a marked man, which was to say the least chilling. He left our offices. We at that point bumped everyone else on the show to hear what he had to say. And he would go back to Nigeria. He would be executed with 8 other minority rights activists. And Tia and Carl show this section in the film, and it just chills you to the bone. He was killed, and then we went to investigate another story that we learned about on the way to Nigeria, which was the Chevron Corporation in the Niger Delta. And we went through the nooks and the crannies of the Niger Delta, Jeremy and I, with a number of Nigerians who took us there. And we learned of the killing of 2 Nigerian activists and the jailing of many others. And we went to investigate that and to then question Chevron about it.
Right. And that picture, look how young Jeremy is.
Yeah. So
Jeremy's, I think he's 22 there, Amy, actually. And they came back from Nigeria and did this report, Drilling and Killing, about multinational oil companies' complicity in putting down these protests. And they won a George Polk Award. I mean, Jeremy must be the youngest person to ever win a George Polk Award for journalism.
It was called Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship.
When you say it like that, it almost feels like I'm hearing you in my ear in the morning.
Hi, Jeremy.
Another photo of young Jeremy. Not exactly sure where this is from. Where is it? Looks like an amphitheater, but this one I personally, this is my favorite. I just recently came back from Cuba and I saw this young Jeremy with the fitted backwards hat next to Asada Shakur. It's an Amon Jordan. Okay. I don't know how you let this guy be around you with this outfit.
But wait a second. Can you tell us a little about your Cuba trip? Because it's amazing what you did.
Yeah. So we went alongside Progressive International. I'm good friends with some of the organizers there. And I hit him up right as Trump had accelerated the oil blockade. It actually started in 2019. With the secondary sanctions, a lot of people don't even know that, but like it got significantly worse in you know the last couple of months, where the Trump administration decided no oil shipments from any country whatsoever. This was right after the Venezuela operation, where they kidnapped Maduro, cutting off a lifeline that Cuba was relying on. And I hit my friend up, David Adler, and I was like, "What do we do?" And he's like, "I'm already working on it." So we put together this group. We worked alongside Code Pink, the Answer Coalition, brought an international group of artists, activists, politicians, and the like, and we brought in 40 tons of aid, medical aid, food, necessary supplies.
This is after one blackout after another in Cuba.
Yeah, and at that point, it was they had experienced, I think, like 36 hours of rolling blackouts, and it was devastating. I had talked to Ben Rhodes prior to going, to get a feel for what it was going to be like, and he said to me, like, "You're going to be very sad when you see it." And he was right. I was very sad when I first I was taken aback by how beautiful the island is. But then I was very sad about all this poverty. And then I got very angry because I was like, we're doing this to this country of 10 million people. That's unfortunately 90 miles off of our coastline. And I say unfortunately because I feel like we've never allowed this island nation to breathe. And we've limited so much potential that Cuba has, and all for an ideological purpose. At first, because there was a lot of industries that Cuban Americans owned that I guess the American government was not fond of the seizure of. But then after that, it turned into this ideological war, and it still carries on in that similar vein. But yeah, it was a total devastation. I interviewed doctors. Both responsible for the medical missions. They were so sad that Marco Rubio had successfully severed medical missions in Jamaica and numerous other countries. Some of the countries had said no, like Italy had said no to severing the medical missions.
I was in Haiti after the earthquake.
Wow.
And the number of Cuban doctors who were there helping, I mean, some whole hospitals were run by Cuban doctors.
Yeah. It's they're tremendous. The Cuban government, I believe, sends more doctors to poor countries around the world than the G7 nations combined.
Yeah.
And I think Marco Rubio said he wanted to have them investigated for human trafficking.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
they tried to send doctors to New Orleans after Katrina.
Yeah, exactly.
And were denied, but because we couldn't take care of our own or we wouldn't.
Yeah. And it's a technically principled stance against any sort of socialized medicine that the American government carries on, where they're like denying other countries. But I was talking to the head of the medical missions, and he was telling me that like they had 100% coverage in Jamaica. And now there's so many parts of Jamaica, we're just never going to see another doctor ever again. And he was telling me like, the Jamaican politicians that responded to this pressure, they can maybe get platinum healthcare in their countries. They can even fly to America to get this. But like poor Jamaicans that live in the countryside are never going to be able to see another healthcare professional because of this decision. It was devastating. One of the things that I also was shocked to find out about was the resilience of the Cuban people, the amount of biomedical research they've conducted. They've had a lung cancer vaccine since the 90s. America's restricted the distribution of said lung cancer vaccine, even though I think it was a collaborative effort with a Colorado university. They have a diabetic ulcer treatment that America is doing its very best to block the distribution of. They were forced to create an indigenous COVID vaccine because the American government stopped Jack Ma's shipment of Sinovacs from entering the island. And not only that, but then also the American government created another vaccine hesitancy campaign. We know about the one in the Philippines that was covered extensively, but apparently there was another vaccine hesitancy campaign in Latin America because they wanted to stop the Cuban vaccines from being distributed in Latin American countries. And they created more vaccine hesitancy campaigns in Latin America. And what's really interesting about the ties of, I guess, American empire and how, you know, all of these foreign adversaries that we've designed as enemies collaborate with one another, oftentimes forced to collaborate with one another, is the fact that the American government alongside Israel bombed the Pasteur Institute in Iran. That was the institute that was in coordination with, I think, Havana. That was the institute that created that indigenous COVID vaccine that made its way to, you know, Latin American countries. All of our, all of the death and destruction, the wars of choice that we engage in, not only totally unnecessary, but it's just like rank cruelty. And seeing it firsthand in Cuba, like seeing the impact of it on the Cuban population, it was devastating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's why it's important to be places to be witnessed.
Oh yeah,
that's what journalists do, and it's such an important job, and it's such an important service. And you know, it shouldn't be a business. It shouldn't be dictated by the business interests of the parent corporation. And that's what the problems be right now. You know, it's not a new thing, but we just happen to have an openly transactional president who has pulled back the curtain and doesn't even try and hide it.
There is a little bit of opportunity there, though, at least in my experience. What I've found is that the way in which Trump communicates the vulgar nature of American empire has been illuminating for a lot of people that may have inadvertently believed in the liberal interventionist attitude, where they thought, you know, sometimes America engages in cruel actions, but it's all for a good purpose. Now that Trump has just ripped that shroud and is very open about how violent he is and how he's doing this for, you know, extraction of natural resources and the like, I think that there are a lot of liberals that might recognize the true nature of American foreign intervention.
And not only liberals. I think what Trump is doing is really cutting across the political spectrum, in some cases uniting people across the political spectrum against him.
Yeah.
How long were you in Cuba? How long?
Only for 3 days.
You know, our motto is, and it's exactly what you did, is go to where the silence is.
Yeah.
And, you know, often it's not exactly silent. It's raucous. It's rowdy. People are organizing. But it doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen. And that's why it's so important to break the silence.
Yeah. Offering a voice to the voiceless. There's always a perspective of the populations that are withstanding American intervention, sometimes even violent intervention. And I always find it interesting that we never get to hear from them, right? Even if it doesn't suit the purpose of the American State Department, like, we should still hear from them. This is one of the things that I really appreciate about like what DropSite does as well, which is to go directly to the Hamas Politburo and to talk to the Ansar Allah movement and hear what their attitude is and where they're at. I think everyone in mainstream news also has that opportunity. They just choose not to engage in that because they're terrified that they might hear an argument that they understand, that their audiences might be receptive to.
Yeah, and I think also they don't have the freedom within those institutions. I mean, let's give the benefit of the doubt to most of the people who decide they want to be a journalist and that they want to do it because they believe in the public's right to know. But, you know, people choose to work in these institutions that don't give them the freedom to really live up to that ideal. And, you know, it's one of the things we're seeing now with so many people fleeing and going on their own, not unlike what you do, but there are people who've been in the legacy media for a long time who are either out of a job now or they're leaving because they don't like what's happening. And they're finding ways to do it on their own. And it's why this idea of trickle-up journalism that Amy and Democracy Now! Practice, you know, where you want the stories to infiltrate and to come up, is why we called this film Steal This Story, Please, right?
Yeah.
It's not steal the story, please. It's not, hey, you want this story. It's steal this story, please, you know, do your fucking job.
Yeah. And this experience for yourself is you know, not always a comfortable one, right? Your career is filled with incredible moments of standing up to power, from being the only reporter aboard the plane with the ousted Haitian president, Aristide, when he attempted to return to Haiti, to being badly beaten by Indonesian soldiers in 1991. You've literally risked your life for the truth. Sure, a lot of people have asked this question already, but what keeps you motivated after all these years? And in retrospect, do you think you're crazy for doing everything that you've done?
Well,
have you ever been asked that question before?
You know, covering President Aristide was an amazing experience because he wasn't the victim of one U.S.-backed coup, but two. And the U.S. took him out of Haiti. He was the democratically elected president, him and his wife, Mildred Aristide, and sent him on a plane to the Central African Republic. This so enraged Trans-Africa, which is an amazing group that was founded by Randall Robinson, who has since died, that he, Maxine Waters, the congresswoman from here, Los Angeles, a Jamaican parliamentarian, got a plane and went to the Central African Republic to bring him back. He was basically under house arrest there. And I got a call from Randall Robinson, and he said, would you want to cover this? And I said, absolutely, I want to be there. He would later tell me that his wife, that Randall's wife, had said to him, what are you doing? You're a plane, a small plane of black people. This was under George Bush, Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. And he said, you're a small plane of black people. You could be blown right out of the sky. You have to have someone white with you. So I didn't realize that's when he called me, Randall Robinson. Oh. He said, would you like to come cover this trip? And so then when Randall Robinson's wife said, I don't understand, you're going? Did you get someone? He said, yes, I called Amy Goodman. And she said, oh, no, you're going to get blown out of the sky even faster. But anyway, we all went to Bangui, and they negotiated with Bazize, CAR leader, who was in power for a year and wanted to look like he had the imprimatur his country, and they got the Aristides back. But as they were coming back to Haiti, Rumsfeld and Powell and Condoleezza Rice threatened them and said, you are not to come back to this hemisphere. To which Randall Robinson replied, whose hemisphere? Like, what are they talking about? They would go into exile in South Africa for 7.5 years. And then I went to South Africa with Danny Glover, who had always wanted to make a film about Toussaint Louverture, the independence leader of Haiti, and followed them back in a plane to Haiti when they successfully landed. And the response was enormous in the streets. I mean, that was an incredible experience. From that to, I mean, East Timor is a story of epic horror. It's one of the great genocides of the late 20th century. A third of the population was killed by the Indonesian military, which was armed, trained, and financed by the United States. They invaded December 7th, 1975, and for the next quarter of a century, they killed off the people. And I covered East Timor, went there with my colleague Alan Nairn, who was writing for The New Yorker, and on November 12th, 91, we witnessed and survived a massacre of over 270 Timorese. We thought our presence as Western journalists could head off the attack because we came from the same country the Indonesian soldiers' weapons came from.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it did not head off that attack. But as information came back to the United States, and you see that scene in the film when I'm questioning Mike McCurry, the spokesperson for President Clinton, Congress actually had cut off military training aid to Indonesia. Was Clinton really going to restore it? And he got angry, McCurry, and he said, the turnip is dry. And what was most interesting about that whole interaction with the White House press corps is that a bunch of the journalists giggled with him, laughed. And that kind of peer pressure, you know, who cares? Because we're talking about lives here. We're talking about life and death situations. But in 1999, the people of East Timor got to vote for their freedom in a UN-sponsored referendum. And 3 years later, they became one of the newest nations in the world.
Yeah. So Democracy Now, throughout the last couple of decades, has been competing with corporate industry titans like CNN and Fox for 30 years while sustaining itself on a financial model of newer, leaner publications like DropSite or Zatteo. How do you view Democracy Now's role in this transition towards viewer-supported news? And how do you expect the news landscape to change in the next 30 years?
I can't predict how it's going to change. Couldn't have predicted social media platforms. But what we do is go to where people are. And so we started 30 years ago. There wasn't even the word podcast. We had to figure out how this 59-minute show was going to get to radio stations. So we put it on the intertubes. We put it at democracynow.org, and radio stations could take it. Other networks, you know, would pay money to put it on satellites. We didn't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
But because we established democracynow.org, we immediately, before almost all other networks, had a global audience. And then we'd have, you know, you have the headlines. And then you'd have segment one, maybe someone in Mexico would transcribe it. Segment two, someone in Montana. Segment three, someone in South Africa. We'd have our transcription coordinator post it online, and we'd have the full transcript. This built the audience. And then reporters could take these voices to the press briefing of the Pentagon or the State Department or the White House. And these are the original voices, right? Not like those pundits, what I was saying before, who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong, and asking the president, the Pentagon spokesperson, the Secretary of Defense, and others.
So they weren't podcasts then, though. I was just talking to Amy's colleague, Dennis, yesterday about this, and they called them, I think, is it
MP4s?
RSS-enabled MP3.
And that's how stations started taking it. And then that was 1996. And 5 years later, the week of the 9/11 attacks, we were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero. I was telling you, we worked out of this downtown community TV where the Renault brothers worked. And we just kept broadcasting. The first plane at the first tower minutes before we went to air. The second plane hit the second tower at 9:03. We were broadcasting at the time 9 to 10. Now we do 8 to 9. And we didn't know what had happened, but people started running down the streets covered in ash. And we broadcast for hour upon hour. And then I knew we couldn't leave because we were within the evacuation zone. If we left our broadcast site, we would not be allowed back. So we stayed there. There was this hammock that I would try to sleep in at night. I'd walk around near the pile. Everything was covered in this, just in ash. And then station after station, TV station, then it was public access station, mm-hmm. started to ask, can we run Democracy Now? Those are TV stations. We're sending out so many video cassettes. I bet half your audience doesn't even know what a video cassette is. and then when we would send out those, the college station would ask in a town, a radio station, can we run you? Then the PBS station, then the NPR station, all the Pacifica radio stations were running us. And that's how it grew to almost 1,500 stations. Also, our headlines available in Spanish. We have them translated right after the show. So many in Latin America also take our headlines.
And that's how they stole the story.
And that's how, and I mean, you asked, so listener, viewer, reader, supported. That's who we turned to from early on, but it was global. And that's what made the difference.
In the film, the interviewees often say that other journalists simply do not ask the important questions that you do. Why don't they ask those questions?
Well, part of it, I think, is the access of evil. Trading truth for access. That's pretty straightforward. And Democracy Now! Is a brain trust of all those people we've been talking about, just people dedicated to the mission of independent media. And we work really hard. I mean, the producers comb the world looking for people who are closest to the story. And then with that knowledge of what has happened, questioning those in power. And also having debate and discussions among, you know, people who deeply care about issues, but they don't necessarily agree. And I think that's what makes for this vibrant, really a vibrant grassroots global news hour that Democracy Now! Is. And stations every month are picking us up. But online, you know, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, wherever people are, we go. We don't expect people just come to us. Mm-hmm. We have to reach out.
One thing I've noticed is that you rarely offer your own personal opinion when you cover a story, your own personal commentary. But I'm sure you'd be the first to say that the very language we use to cover an objective story is always going to have its own bias. You know, for example, passive voice whenever mainstream reporters are covering incidents that pertain to police violence, or even that translates to, you know, state violence. No matter how closely it resembles terrorism, like in the case of Israel. How do you view your role in shaping narratives and providing your insight into current events?
Again, speaking to people closest to the story and hearing their descriptions of what's happening. I mean, the horror of Gaza, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of journalists have been killed. I mean, most recently, just last week, an Al Jazeera reporter, and Israel completely admitted it. I said they targeted him. I was just thinking about Rafat Al-Adir, because for our 30th anniversary, in addition to the musicians. And by the way, I don't know if you knew this. Do you know Peaceable Kingdom by Patti Smith was actually written about Rachel Corrie, who I was talking about earlier?
I did not know that.
About what she did in Rafah in Gaza, which was fascinating. But Rafat Al-Adir, he is the poet who wrote If I Must Die. We interviewed him in Gaza, revered poet and professor, teacher. He was killed with his family. And at Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary, we were joined by Mossab Abu Toha. So we played Rafat on Democracy Now! And then we played Mossab remembering Rafat. And we played Brian Cox, who is the star of Succession, reading If I Must Die. And then Mossab came out trying to keep his composure. He just won the Pulitzer Prize for his essays in The New Yorker and his poetry. And he read his poem, Under the Rubble. And there is nothing more eloquent, more real, less debatable than someone describing their own experience. And, you know, I go back to the beginning of Pacifica. Pacifica was founded like three quarters of a century ago, 49, by a war resistor, came out of the detention camps in Berkeley, founded KPFA, 1949. Here in Los Angeles, 1959 was KPFK. In New York, 1960 was WBAI. 1977, Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW in Washington, where we're going to be going and doing a big event with them on May 1st, and in Houston, KPFT. We're also going to be having a big fundraiser there with the film coming out there. KPFT goes on the air in 1970. Within a few weeks, the Ku Klux Klan straps dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blows it up. So KPFT acted fast. You know, the community built the station. They rebuilt the transmitter. And right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant, the Klan strapped 15 times the dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it up a second time. And I thought Arlo Guthrie's song is good. I like Alice's Restaurant, but it was blown off the air. So then it takes months to go to rebuild. And January 1971, Arlo Guthrie comes back to Houston and finishes the song on the air. And it's never stopped broadcasting. I can't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, because I often confuse their titles, the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it is a Palestinian child or an Israeli peace activist who lost his parents on October 7th, like Maoz Inam, who's working together with Aziz Abu Sara, and they just wrote a book, The Future is Peace. Whether it is an aunt in Afghanistan or an uncle in Iraq, you may not even like the uncle he reminds you of, that uncle, but it challenges the caricatures and the stereotypes that fuel these hate groups. It makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy someone. when you simply hear them speak. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back.
Absolutely. It was powerful. Okay, so you've covered stories all around the world. We briefly talked about it, but what was the trip that had the biggest impact on your life? I don't know if it's a corny question or not, but what was the trip that had the biggest impact on your life? And do you ever take any fun, relaxing vacations that don't involve paramilitary groups?
Oh my God. Sitting on my couch with Zazu is like, for 20 minutes is like a month on the Riviera. Is that a good enough answer?
That's a great answer. It's one that I would probably give because there's a question that I get asked all the time as well. So I wanted to carry
it
over to
you. Well, I'm not broadcasting live 24 hours a day.
I know, but you have been tirelessly doing this, you know.
I wouldn't say I'm tireless. I can still be tired and do it.
Yeah. Well, but you've been doing this for so consistently for so many decades that it's just like I had to ask you that question. This is one that I receive all the time.
Let me try. I know you're asking Amy, but Amy's so used to centering other voices and other people that I think it's sort of ingrained in her DNA not to be able to answer a direct question about herself.
Yeah.
Because she's very selfless. But she talked about it earlier, and I'm just speaking because I immersed myself in the last 30 years. My partner T and I did, and you know, when Amy, there's no bullshit coming out of Amy when she believes everything she says, and she lives her life by these ideals. And so when she says that surviving the massacre and witnessing those murders in East Timor by an army that was armed and financed and trained by the United States, that changed her. She means it. And then off of that, her reporting changed what was happening in East Timor because it became part of a much larger movement. And that's, I think, so objectively speaking, as an outside observer who had nothing to do with what Amy did, seeing the power that you have as a journalist, that your voice can have to change the course of history or to influence the course of history, I think was the most life-changing thing that I've seen her experience.
I mean, in that case, it was the people on the ground, especially these young people in Timor. They weren't even born when Indonesia invaded and illegally occupied them, but they were the ones who were standing up. And that is incredibly inspiring, even when their friends, when their neighbors were killed. And so many of these interviews in Timor, in Haiti, here in the United States, interviewing people in Gaza through this period, in Iran. I mean, it is amazing to talk to Iranians in the diaspora, Iranians in Iran. But I mean, the professors, the artists, the poets, the people who themselves have been victims of the regime, you know, on death row in the Evin prison, notorious prison. But they are saying now, no, this is not going to improve the situation for us and our colleagues, the dissidents, our compatriots in Iran right now. It will harden this regime. This is not what we think will further any kind of democracy. It's just amazing to hear people speak for themselves. And they're the ones who change history, to point a mic in their direction, to shine a spotlight on what they're doing. That's the honor of my life. I wanted to give you a poster.
One right there.
Oh, here it is. Here it is.
Well, check this out. You know who Shepherd Fairey is?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Artist.
Yeah, the amazing, started as a street artist. He works in all kinds of media.
He did the Barack Obama Hope and Change poster.
The Hope and Change poster. Yeah. Well, he did this. He's also a fan of hers, not of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered to do this poster, and it's just beautiful because what I love about it here is it's the fist in the air, and the weapon is the microphone.
Yeah.
And we just went to Shepherd Fairey's studio, and we told him we wanted to give this to you. And again, at the top, it says, go to where the silence is and say something. And that's really very much where Carl and Tia end the documentary.
Yeah.
But
you have to sign this for Hassan.
Oh, I'm going to sign it.
Yeah. That is, what an honor. I have another question for you. Again, somewhat of a corny one, but you've basically interviewed every single person from Bill Clinton to Noam Chomsky and some of Jeffrey Epstein's other friends as well. Who was the most, what was the most important interview that you've ever conducted?
Oh, man.
Tough. It's a tough question.
I cannot say the most important interview. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
And then look, I have to show you something. In the background, this is when Sharif got arrested. And then I also got arrested along with him. This is the standoff at Standing Rock covering it. And these underneath these, what are called laurels, I'm only learning this world of the film festivals, but they are amazing, these film festivals. And this is not... my work. This is Carl and Tia's work. They have won so many awards, grand jury prizes, as I was saying before, and audience favorite documentaries, which is why I want all you guys who are watching and listening right now to go out to your favorite movie theater and either get them to run it or go to the theaters that are running it. And we're here in Los Angeles to really... Well, one is to talk to you and, you know, do these fundraisers for Pacifica stations like KPFK. Do you think I avoided your question?
A little bit. It's okay. You can do that.
To come back. I have to think about the answer. But I know one thing is I won't choose just one because so many are important for so many reasons. Each story I've described to you now includes so many interviews, whether it is Rafat Al-Arir, whether it is covering the journey of President Aristide of Haiti, whether it is talking to Alia Rahman, this remarkable woman who stands for so many people who've been brutalized in this immigrant crackdown. It just goes on and on.
Carl, I got some tough questions for you, too. Don't worry.
Every day.
Okay. Yeah, I'm waiting.
Okay, so you took 30 very memorable years of Amy's life, and you condensed it into 98 minutes. Okay? What were the hardest editorial sacrifices, and was there anything you cut from the film that you wish you kept in?
It's a process. You know, what you do is real time. What we do is a couple years of work. And especially when you immerse yourself in 30 years of somebody's career and life, it's really hard. I'd say in a weird way, Steal This Story, Please is also a very personal story for me and for Tia, because it's a reflection of the things that Amy has done throughout her life that have impacted us the most profoundly and that sit with us to this day. So I'd say, you know, the choices are difficult to make. When we had a hard choice, when we had 3.5 hours of a film, and we knew that we couldn't put out 3.5 hours of a film, you know, we had to impose some process. And that was whatever was speaking most clearly and profoundly to the moment that we're living in now stayed in the film. That. And the other big rule, which has always been a rule, which we learned from Michael Moore, is you never take a laugh out. And Amy Goodman is a barrel of laughs. She has so much fun in this life. She is surrounded by so many great people. Amy never says no to an invitation to do something fun, to be out on the town, to be walking on the street, and she's always laughing. And so we wanted to, you know, that appeals to us. Who doesn't like somebody who likes to have fun and finds joy? And it's important for telling the story about a person, even though the film is admittedly, it's about a much bigger thing than Amy Goodman, but you know, it makes Amy so relatable.
You know, I was just looking at this picture you have up of,
Drilling of and Killing.
Jeremy Scahill and a much younger me, Drilling and Killing Chevron Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. I think this was at the Polk Awards, and they had us do a large poster. But it made me think about the Overseas Press Club Awards, because we had won an Overseas Press Club award for this. And I'm not here to boast about that, but we learned about the ceremony. It was at a Midtown hotel, and we thought, okay, I mean, I think it was in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia. And we had so much work to do but we're supposed to go and collect this award. So Jeremy and I raced over to the hotel, and we couldn't actually afford to sit and have the meal because it was expensive. It was hundreds of journalists who were there. Mm-hmm. So we went as press covering our own awards. And but what we saw there was Richard Holbrooke. And he was the U.S. envoy on Yugoslavia at the time. And this was, oh my gosh, it's almost exactly like 27 years ago. And we said, oh my God, this is fantastic. Because we're at this award ceremony, we get to speak to people you wouldn't normally get to speak to. And so this is a real opportunity. We had our tape recorder because we're going to cover our own award ceremony. So we ran up to Mr. Holbrooke and we said, he had just given a speech talking about how how NATO had bombed the RTS building. That's Radio Television Serbia. Right. They were taking out the body parts of the makeup artists, of the camera people. It was horrifying. This is a civilian site. And so we wanted to ask him a question. And
here he is at a prestigious award ceremony surrounded by journalists.
That's right. This was the perfect moment.
Yeah.
Right before he spoke, we went up to ask him because we thought maybe we won't get a chance to. Actually, he was going into the bathroom, so we were following him to the bathroom. But he said, no, they made a deal here that I would not answer questions. And the head of the Overseas Press Club came over and said to us, what are you doing? And so I said, well, we were asking Mr. Holbrooke a question. He's the point person on NATO bombing Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we made a deal. We're not going to ask him questions because he's our keynote speaker. So then we go back in and they're announcing the awards and they come to the award that we were winning. And it was one of the network news anchors. And I think it was Tom Brokaw. And he said, and now the Overseas Press Club Award goes to drilling and killing Nigeria's oil dictatorship. Jeremy had gone up right before when Mr. Holbrooke had just finished his speech and said, Mr. Holbrooke, because he wanted to ask him a question then. That was our second
Jeremy
attempt.
Doing that.
And I was standing at the back of the room and they had security take him out. And so I was at the back and as they're taking Jeremy out, I said, release that man. He's just about to win an award. And they were very confused. They didn't know what to do. And when Brokaw announced that we had won the award, I went up. Jeremy had already been taken out, so now it's just me. And I go up on the stage and I said, Mr. Brokaw, I want to thank you for the Overseas Press Club Award, but we're going to have to refuse it. Meanwhile, I'm thinking, oh my God, I didn't even ask Jeremy, but he's been taken out. I don't have the opportunity. I hope he's okay with us refusing this award.
Yeah.
And I said, we're going to have to refuse the award because we came to this event, which honors the highest in journalism, and yet we were told that a deal had been made, that an agreement had been made with a person who's a key player in the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, that we're not allowed to ask him questions. So I want to say thank you, but no thank you. And Brokaw said, well, that's why the First Amendment is great. And that was the end of that. So it's so when I see that picture of us, I asked Jeremy after, did you mind that I'm so sorry that we're not bringing home this award. And so given that he had been taken out, he definitely understood and supported the decision.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I think it was during the Columbia campus, student encampments that were taking place. I believe it was like the Pulitzer Hall that was like offering, or the journalism school was setting guidelines on what their students were able to report in the student newspaper because they were worried that the Trump administration, or not even the Trump administration, the Biden administration at the time, was going to enforce these restrictions. Or was it under the Trump administration? But I just thought that it was very interesting that, like,
was under Biden. Yes.
Yeah, we're teaching this next generation in an incredibly prestigious university, the same, that carries the same name as an award that is given to reporters where we were teaching them that, you know, you have to censor yourself ahead of time instead of conducting what you're supposed to do as a reporter, as a journalist. It's a very interesting lesson in, I guess, that hypocrisy that has been going on for far longer.
I have a question.
Okay.
Do you have the trailer?
Do I have the trailer? I can find it. I don't think I have it right here, but no, I don't have the trailer here. I can find it, though.
Stealthisstory.org.
Oh, it's there. Oh, right. It sure it's right is. There. I think you hear Jeremy in it, right?
You hear Jeremy in it.
And you hear Sharif in it. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Right. Can you tell us what you think about President Trump saying climate change is a Chinese hoax? So
this is
so
the chase. Funny. Yeah.
Right, but you weren't running away when you were just standing there.
But this is the trailer, yes. Yeah.
My first impressions of Amy.
What did you say to those who say that you're a war criminal?
Man, I was asking Bush
don't
that.
Push me. No.
Independent media is the oxygen of a democracy.
What do you mean by independent?
Not being sponsored by corporations.
Amy's chaotically brilliant at the spy game.
We began on 9 radio stations.
If she believes something, she's going to fight for it and get it out to the world. Straight up journalism.
It came from my Jewish education that you ask questions.
Sharif, can you talk about what's happened on the Gaza Strip?
From Ground Zero, from East Timor, as we deplane in Haiti, from Georgia's death row prison.
We had to smuggle in our recording equipment. This was extremely dangerous. We're accusing a powerful American corporation of murder.
Without any warning, the military opened fire on the protesters. They put the guns to our heads. It is critical that we expose what is done in our name.
Patty
Donald
Smith
Trump understood
Dylan.
Corporate owners of the media would do anything for money.
She taught me, speak to the people at the target's end of the bomb. Speak to those who are being deliberately silenced.
When you hear someone speak, it's less likely you'll want to destroy them.
We expand the frame and center those voices.
There is a great force that would like to silence us.
The press is the enemy of the people.
And that's the only thing to
look. No, we're not going to let it happen.
Wow.
One thing missing from that, a pull quote from Hassan Piker. That's what we need.
No.
You mean wow?
No.
Yeah.
Just wow.
Yeah, just wow.
Oh,
yeah.
I have many words to say. Yeah, you could have put me fangirling. but
hey, it almost made the film. It was in the cut for a little while.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Damn,
yes.
You put me on the you edited me out. Now we got to get the real deal, the Carl Deal cut.
Yeah.
But also Juan Gonzalez throughout this film, who's been with Democracy Now! For 30 years, he had 2 DNs, like the New York Daily News he was with for 29 years. And he had Democracy Now!, which he's still with. And his wisdom, his journalistic prowess, you know, he began way back. He was part of Columbia Student Strike of 1968, one of the leaders, and then went on to found the New York chapter of the Young Lords with a group of people. And one of the things he says in the documentary, which is so profound, you see this group of Puerto Rican, I mean, they're like the Puerto Rican Black Panthers.
Yeah.
As he says, we managed to frame our own story, to shape our own narrative. When you look at that circle of Puerto Rican activists, you realize almost everyone became a journalist.
Yeah.
And he said, that is the most important thing you can do. And that's the whole idea behind Steal This Story, Please. It's really about shaping the narrative and putting it out there.
Last question, because I feel like I've kept you here for far too long. And thank you so much.
You mean you're going to make us late to the screening tonight? We're doing it with Pamela Adlon, right?
Yeah, Pamela Adlon. We're going to
is going to be the moderator of this. And then tomorrow, but it's a surprise. The 2 KPFK fundraisers. Again, go to kpfk.org and get your tickets there. But you could even show up at the tomorrow if you're here at the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles. And I bet they'll be able to have tickets for you. But if you're in Seattle, Washington, or you're in Portland, Oregon, if you are in
Seattle,
IFC in New York,
San Francisco, if you're in Berkeley, if you're in Sonoma, if you're in Chicago, if you're in D.C. Boston.
We're going to be all over San Francisco this weekend.
Everyone keeps saying you got to hit her with the, you have 10 seconds left. You have 20 seconds. You
okay, 30 seconds. That's right. Okay.
Every time when
this
I hear that.
This is exhilarating, getting the instant feedback.
I can't get over this. Oh
every time
God.
I hear that, I'm like, no, I need to hear more. But what I was gonna say is there's been a real sea change in attitudes over Israel's conduct in the last 2.5 years now. And I feel like that is, of course, the lion's share of that burden comes from the Palestinians, who were able to communicate the atrocities that were taking place in real time, sometimes in their final moments. And
again, think of all those hundreds of journalists.
Yeah. And not even just reporters who are unbelievably brave, but even regular, ordinary Palestinians under constant threat by the Israeli occupation, being bombarded, having their lives destroyed. I feel like that was like in large part due to their bravery, and also because of the fact that independent media, by way of both social media and places like Democracy Now!, were able to take that footage and try to honor the sacrifice, the martyrdom, honor the work that Palestinians put in to showcasing the reality on the ground. Do you feel like there are lessons that mainstream media could learn from that? How do you feel? I mean, you've covered this issue. You've covered the apartheid for decades. It didn't start on October 7, as many people might think. Do you see that sea change? Do you feel like it was rapid?
Completely. And I completely see a sea change. Yes, I was there covering the first Intifada, and carrying through to today, the strength of voices there and also here, and being a Jewish journalist and coming from a religious Jewish background. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi on my mother's side, and my great-grandfather on my father's side was a Hasidic rabbi. He was the Henry Street rabbi in Lower East Side. I also really carefully monitor the Jewish community and the sea change, especially among young people.
Yeah.
I know this causes APEC great concern.
Oh, yeah.
And why I've always been amazed at the universities going after students who are part of the encampments is so much of what students learn, yes, from their own background, but when they come to college and they take human rights classes and they learn about what's legal and illegal in international law, universities should have seen it as such a tribute of the learning and the education of their students. But from my perspective, steeped in the Holocaust, as my family was, my grandmother, a woman of three centuries, born in 1897 in Rivne, Ukraine, though it was Poland and Russia at the time, she lived till she was 108 in 2005. She died in Brooklyn. I was steeped in who died and who lived, what family members were able to flee and what weren't able and who wasn't able to flee. And I was always struck by non-Jewish people who and families who would harbor Jews, protect them, put a child in the basement or the attic or in a barn simply to protect them from the Nazis. And I'd always wonder, they're called the righteous. Why would they do this? Risk their own families' lives. And we learned a deep, deep lesson through the horror of the Holocaust. And that was never again for anyone, anywhere. And I think it is not only my Jewish education, I think for Muslims, Hindus, Christians, agnostics, atheists, this is a humanistic education. We cannot afford war anymore. We cannot afford this mass victimization. As reporters, we know no borders, and it is absolutely critical today that these issues be solved on the ground, empowering people to live in a more just society.
Oh, powerful words to end it on. Thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, this was a real honor. I listen to you every morning. So I hear your voice right. All the time.
Well, people can check it out on the video and audio podcast at democracynow.org and all social media.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for having us on, and thank you for what you do. You know, and don't let them silence you.
Oh no, I'm good. I it's not happening anytime soon. Yeah, good, I didn't want to get into any of the drama. I don't know how aware you are of like all the other stuff that's going on. I'm a little bit of the main point of contention in a lot of legacy publishers right now. My affiliation with campaigns has been brought up by right wing think tanks, AIPAC, ADL, and numerous other organizations are trying to forcibly sever my ties with Democratic elected representatives and people who are campaigning, but it hasn't worked so far. Yeah. So, and I don't think it'll work at all.
Yeah,
because we are now, due to in large part your work, your tireless work for many, many years, we're in a very different media environment where the independent media that is truly independent, independent of the corporate shackles, the golden shackles that corporations offer, can communicate truth to power, and the audience is much more receptive to it, and they demand it. Hopefully, the lesson that they can learn from that is to reestablish credibility that they've lost and do true contentious adversarial reporting, investigative reporting, and not just investigative reporting every now and then, so they can like claw back a little bit of that legitimacy that they've lost, but just like consistently engage in that. But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. This is a real honor.
Thank you so much, Hassan. And thank you so much to this amazing tens of thousands of people who are listening and watching right now. This is what community looks like.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.